give you Professor John Oakes.
Great. It's good to be here tonight. Everything's working, right? Excellent. All right. Yeah, I'm not exactly on the top of my game. First of all, I had a Five Guys burger, and that kind of sits heavy in your stomach, you know. We don't have those in California. We have In-N-Out, but Five Guys is definitely better than In-N-Out. Definitely.
There you go. Let's go.
Also, I just got back from a 16-day trip to Korea and Philippines, and a little jet lag. I think I slept about 1 hour last night. You know, one of those things like that. That was quite a trip. I was flying from Manila to San Diego. And we went through Tokyo, and they got a snowstorm. It never snows. And they shut down the airport, stuck in the plane for 7 hours, and then when they let us out, all they had was a marble floor to sleep on. That was quite a night. Can you imagine? Yeah, the guy with a little age on him says, oh, wow, sleeping on marble. That doesn't seem like a great idea. But anyway, we're here. Glad to be here. By the way, I am a Wisconsinite, and I do root for the Packers. I'm sorry. Of course, this year the Packers, you know, were easily taken over by Minnesota, obviously.
Yes,
Minnesota.
That's it.
All right. Anyway, so I'll be giving a talk, 45 minutes to an hour or so. We'll have lots of time for question and answer, which I think that's great, especially in a college setting here. So anyway, let me get a little bit of my background. I grew up going to church. It was a denomination, a fairly liberal denomination. I was the guy who carried the cross around and wore the funny robes and that kind of stuff. And I was president of the church youth group. The only problem is I didn't believe in God. I was an atheist. So I went off to college. It didn't seem to matter in that church. That was interesting. So I went off to college. I was pretty proud of being an atheist. I remember studying philosophy that freshman year, and Nietzsche, who said God was dead, is like, yeah, that's cool. I thought that was so cool. But then I was studying chemistry and physics, and I came to realize that there's a God. So I came to believe in God because of science. Now, the thing is, I wasn't committed at all to Christianity per se. To me, the God I believed in was the one who created the universe. I didn't really know which kind. So it was about a 2.5-3 year, you know, one of those searching kind of journey sort of thing. Became a vegetarian, kind of interested in Buddhism and Hinduism, before I finally came around to reading the Bible. And at that point, I became a Christian about 39 years ago at the University of Colorado. Wow. By the way, students, it was one of my students who shared with me, okay? Wow. There you go. All right. So think about that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about why I, as a scientist, say belief in God is the only rational view. So there are two perspectives.
All right.
One I'll present would be the atheist perspective, the unbelieving perspective, represented by Thomas Huxley, otherwise known as Darwin's bulldog. By the way, Thomas Huxley invented the word agnostic, just so you know. Anyway, he said, we are as much the product of blind forces as is the falling of a stone to earth or the ebb and flow of the tides. We just happened. And man was made flesh by a series of singularly beneficial accidents. So Thomas Huxley looks at the world and says, it's all just an accident. A more modern version of this would be from our good old friend Richard Dawkins, right? Wrote The God Delusion. He said, in the universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, others are going to get lucky. You won't find any rhyme or reason, no justice. The universe has precisely the properties we should expect if there's at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares, it just is, and we dance to its music. Now, if nothing else, that's a pretty depressing view. But the thing is, at the universities, this is assumed to be the view that all scientists take. And they do it in a way that you know, almost kind of to intimidate you. And one of the things I want you to take from this lesson is don't be intimidated by these atheists. I was at a conference a few years ago, a bunch of science professors all in a van going from one venue to another. And this one professor said, Christianity, what a stupid religion. Notice she was assuming that everybody in the van, eight or ten of us, were all kind of with her on this, right? She said, yeah, you know, Christianity, It says in the Bible, if you wear clothes with two materials, capital punishment. What a stupid religion. So I said, excuse me, the Bible doesn't say that. She said, yes, it does. I saw it at a website.
Yeah.
All right, there you go. That's her source. So I said, you know, I've heard people say the Bible's full of all kinds of errors, and obviously no scientist could possibly believe in Christianity. I said, I've read it through, I don't know, 5 or 6 times. I haven't found an error yet. I don't know what they're talking about. Can you imagine how quiet it got in that van? And then I pulled out my Bible.
Oh.
Now, I had to find that verse in Leviticus, the one that talks about wearing clothing of more than one material. Could you find that one? Now, luckily, it was my 1970 NIV, and I knew that it was on the right-hand side of the page about halfway down. Said a little prayer, and I read the scripture. My point is this. Don't be intimidated by bald, smart people with looking people with glasses. You know what I'm saying? Don't be intimidated in this idea that somehow unbelief is a more intelligent perspective. So that's one perspective. Another perspective, I need to borrow a cell phone. Thank you. Borrow a cell phone here. I'm not going to make a phone call. It's okay. I'm not going to look up your history or anything like that. The other perspective would be the perspective of design. That looks at the universe and says, not blind, pitiless indifference, it just happened, says there's a design. And that the watchmaker argument, invented by William Paley. Instead of the watchmaker argument, I'm going to go for the cell phone argument. All right, so we see that cell phone. Let's say you're walking down the sidewalk and you see this cell phone there. You're thinking, all right, how'd that get there? Accident or design? Accident. So, you know, there's some plastic, some metal, some glass, and you know, and the cars ran over it, and people stepped on it, and rain. Boom. Cell phone. What do you think about that? That is crazy. Which has more evidence of design? Which has more intricacy and more moving parts than the simplest living thing or a cell phone? The answer is the simplest living thing. And yet people believe it happened by accident. I'd say a better illustration than a cell phone might be a junkyard full of wood and metal and dirt and plastic and glass. Tornado rips through there, and you get a 747. I guess it should be a 787. I need to change my 747s. They don't have them anymore, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I need to change my picture there. It's sometimes called the anthropic principle. See, starting in the late Middle Ages of the Renaissance, it seemed like science was making us smaller and smaller and smaller because we thought we were at the center of the universe. And then we found out, well, we're not at the center. We go around the sun. That's the center. Then we found out, well, actually, the sun's not the center. The sun's just one of many stars in this galaxy. In the 1930s, but actually, there's many galaxies. So now we're a little tiny planet, an insignificant sun, one of hundreds of billions of stars, and one of hundreds of billions of galaxies. Mm-hmm. And we're like, how could humans have this hubris to think we are important in any way? But then, as you look at the facts about science, you realize the entire universe is created so that we could be here. In fact, the only answer to the question why the universe is the way it is, the only answer that works in any way whatsoever is, it's called the anthropic principle. It means a human, right? The idea that the universe is designed for humans. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to go through a little chemistry, a little biology, a little physics, and look at some, yes, it's okay. And I'm going to show you why belief in God is the only rational explanation of reality, at least the physical reality. All right, water, right? Hopefully, when you see the H and the O and the H, you don't really need the label. I could have gotten rid of that label. You're supposed to be laughing now. When I'm telling jokes, please. You know, I was in Korea doing this lesson a couple weeks ago. When they didn't laugh, they had a good excuse because they don't know English. But anyway, never mind. Okay, so anyway, there are several properties that water has that no other molecule has. In fact, you could teach an entire one semester course just to explain all the properties that water has that no other molecule has. And every single one of those properties, if water didn't have those properties, we wouldn't be here. And to argue for just accident seems to not work very well. One of the things about water is it's bent at about 109 degrees. All right, now if you connected three things together, normally it'd be a straight line, all right? That's the geometry of that. But if water was straight instead of bent, it would boil about minus 150 degrees centigrade. We'd all be vaporized. Now, in order for life to exist, it needs a solvent. Solid doesn't work. Gas certainly doesn't work. It needs to be a solvent. And the solvent needs to be able to dissolve a wide range of molecules. Now, guess what molecule dissolves a wider range of molecules than any other? Answer is water. Scientists would also tell you it would have to be a liquid in a certain temperature range from about minus 20 centigrade to about 80 degrees centigrade. And, of course, water is liquid across almost that entire range, but very importantly, not that entire range, as we'll see. Okay, another property that water has is water absorbs by far more heat than any other substance. Most substances, less than one-tenth the heat is absorbed. All other substances, less than half. You say, okay, fine. So the same molecule that has the right solvent properties, the right boiling point, all these things, also has this property. Why is that important? Well, otherwise, the temperature on the Earth in any given year would go up and down by 200 degrees centigrade. Life would not exist. Wow. By the way, in order for life to exist, that solvent needs to be able to dissolve ions, like sodium ion chloride ion, without which you couldn't have a nervous system and no ability to communicate except within a single cell. Guess how many liquids dissolve ions? Exactly one. It's water. Okay, water has some other properties. For example, every other compound has the solid sinking and the liquid floating. Guess how many exceptions there are? Exactly one. Now, when I was teaching in the Philippines, I said, you know, I used to live in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin, people can walk on water. Now, you guys get the joke right away, all right? But in the Philippines, they're there. Really? Anyway. So, right? We can walk on water, ice fishing, the whole... Yeah, okay, got it. Yeah. Okay. Now, so here's the reason that's important. Because in the winter, the colder ice floats on top of the warmer water. And there's another property that water has. This is crazy. All of their substances, as you heat them up, their density goes down. Guess how many exceptions there are? Exactly when it's water. Because below 4 degrees, water actually gets more dense as you cool it off. And then when it turns to ice, it drops. So what happens is you get the colder ice, then the colder water, and then the warmer water. You know, they say hot things rise. Not for water, only exception. Okay, we could talk about the viscosity of water. We could talk about many other things. Thermal conductivity of water. By the way, if water didn't have this property, the solid, fluid, and the liquid, then during the ice ages, the oceans would freeze to the bottom, and all life, other than possibly very, very simple bacteria, would disappear. Now, I tell my chemistry students that Mendeleev invented this chart, all right? Some of you are getting the chills and hives right now, all right? But actually, in my opinion, Mendeleev, he only discovered what was invented by somebody else. And guess who I'm going to claim invented this chart? Starts with a G, ends with a D, right? God. God's fingerprints are all over this chart. There are at least 22 elements that I know that have a property that no other element has. And if that element didn't have that property, there'd be no life. One good question is, why are there so many elements? The Greeks, Aristotle, said four. Why are there so many elements? All right. Well, the anthropic principle says so that there could be life. One element that has unique properties is carbon. I teach organic chemistry. Who was saying she doesn't want to ever take organic chemistry? Okay. It's good stuff. Did you take intro chem yet?
What?
Did you take intro chem yet?
Yep.
See, organic is more fun, honestly.
Fantastic.
All right. But you're not taking it. All right. Anyway. The first two lectures in organic chemistry, I spend the entire time talking about all the properties that carbon has that no other element has. You see the theme here? And every single one of those properties, if carbon didn't have those properties, there'd be no life. The thing is, carbon has to have all those properties. Only one element has all those, and carbon has all those. All right, some of the properties are carbon has four bonds, right? You can confirm that, tetravalent. Let's see if we have some. By the way, there are actually two elements that form four bonds. Let's see if somebody who's in chemistry can tell us. Okay, what's the other element that forms four bonds? Silicon. Right. It's right below carbon in the periodic chart. The problem with silicon is, in order to have life, is if you put two silicon atoms together in a molecule, that molecule explodes. Not a really good basis for life. So why is it important to have four bonds? Well, it turns out, unless you have four bonds, the molecules cannot be three-dimensional. Ah, and if you don't have three-dimensional molecules, you also can't have a three-dimensional living thing. All right, another property that carbon has that no other element has is it forms large, stable molecules. Obviously, life requires large, stable molecules. But the large, stable molecule-forming element also has to have four bonds, also has to be able to form rings and a bunch of other things. I'm skipping other things. I'm giving the ones that are easier to know what I'm talking about. Okay, next is iron. Is this hard? I didn't hear that comment, but all right. Iron, there it is, Fe. Now, iron has a property that no other element has. It's the only element that forms a strong magnetic field. Why is that important? Well, otherwise, how would you put your kids' homework on the refrigerator, right? No. Turns out, by the way, hydrogen is not officially on my list, but hydrogen has the property of fusing to create energy. It's the only element that does that. All right, and so we're over here on the Earth. The sun's over here. We need energy over there. But if a source of energy would be too hot, so we have to put that source of energy really far away. Okay? And almost all the energy coming from the sun is visible light. Lucky for us. Because visible light is the only kind of light that can instigate chemical reactions without breaking apart molecules. The only kind. But there are two kinds of energy that come from the sun, both of which would destroy all life on the Earth. One of them is called solar wind. It's that high-energy electron and protons that leave the sun. But it turns out the magnetic field of the Earth is literally a force field that deflects those ions. Now, this is the cool thing about iron, because it turns out that not only is iron the only magnetic element, it's also the most stable element. The nucleus of iron is the most stable nucleus. So guess what the Earth is made out of, mostly? Iron. Just so happens, the most stable element is also the only magnetic element. So if you had only one magnetic element, but it wasn't the most stable element, there'd be no life. Now, some people think that this is actual chance, an accident. The universe has these properties, but there's no meaning to it, no rhyme, no reason, right? They're called atheists. You know, I sometimes wonder how they can maintain this faith. It takes a mind-boggling faith to believe in atheism. Seriously, I don't know how they maintain faith in this idea that we saw from Dawkins and Huxley. All right, so there's some other elements. We can talk about oxygen. The funny thing about oxygen, it contains two forms, one of which, O2, is the only gas that can sustain a high metabolism life. The other kind, O3, is highly poisonous. And yet, lucky for us, there's almost none of it in the lower atmosphere. All of it in the upper atmosphere, and it absorbs the ultraviolet radiation. Otherwise, guess what? No life. We could talk about many other elements. Let's just do one more, uranium. You probably think uranium's kind of dangerous stuff. You say, why would God make uranium? I mean, if it's a design, there's going to be no mistakes there, because uranium is really dangerous. True, it's dangerous, because it's radioactive. But actually, uranium has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. So believe it or not, uranium is not all that radioactive. I'm not saying you want to live near a uranium mine and, you know, dig around in uranium tailings, but it's the elements it breaks down into that are more dangerous than the uranium. But the property that uranium has is it gives off heat. Now, uranium is the only radioactive substance that has a sufficiently long half-life Otherwise, the earth would be cold all the way to the middle. He's saying, so? Well, if the earth was cold all the way to the middle, you'd have no plate tectonics. And plate tectonics is a massive minerals recycling system. Otherwise, the surface of the earth would be nearly sterile, no advanced life forms. Also, if you have no plate tectonics, no radioactive uranium, you'd have no atmosphere. So if you want to live on a planet with almost no uranium, go to Mars. And, of course, there's no atmosphere virtually, and the surface is sterile. By the way, another property of uranium is it's very, very dense. Lucky for us, because guess where most of the uranium is? In the center of the Earth, providing heat so that we could be alive. And again, like I said, I went to college as an atheist, and in studying science, I reached the conclusion that that really doesn't make sense. Okay, now I see a lot of design in this molecule. This molecule is so awesome, it kind of gives me little chills in the back of my neck. I'm serious, this is amazing stuff. Because DNA contains these nucleotides, and there are not literal letters there. That's just the symbol, cytosine, guanine, adenine, thymine. But the nucleotides, three of those, form a code to pick an amino acid, coded information to make proteins. Now, let me ask you a simple, common sense question. It doesn't require you to have much education, really, any at all. Is this: could molecules randomly bumping into each other create a code? No. That doesn't make sense. The fact is, nature does not create information. That is a fact of thermodynamics. So where did all this information come from? Now, we have about 3 billion of these letters. That's the amount of information in a small library. All right, but the simplest living thing wasn't as complex as us, obviously not even close. Let's talk about, say, an E. coli with 100 billion of these bases, 100 million rather. All right, forget it, 50. All right, 25 million. That's probably just too simple to support actual life. Let's say 25 million. The probability of that information, in other words, the T's and A's, G's and C's, coming together in a way that could have the information to create a living thing, it'd be kind of like this. It'd be like taking 25 million letters, throwing in the air, and when they land on the ground, you could read it. In English. Could anybody believe that would happen no matter how many times you did it? The answer is yes. It's called an atheist. They believe that this information was assembled by accident, by random bumping of molecules into one another. Now, there's another layer of complexity here. It turns out the only thing in the universe that makes proteins is DNA. But guess what the only thing in the universe that makes DNA is? Proteins. Now, you heard about the chicken and the egg, right? So I asked the atheist, which came first? The DNA or the proteins? Because the DNA contains the information, and the proteins do the work. So which you're going to have first, the information or the work? Here's what the atheist believes, and I'm not kidding. They believe that simultaneously, in the same place, the DNA that would have made the protein, but didn't, assembled, and also at the same time, the protein that would have made the DNA. But the protein that got made accidentally would have to be the protein that would make the DNA that would have made that protein, and vice versa. All right, now, if you got lost there, it's okay. You get the point? All right? Compared to the chicken and the egg, that's an easy one. All right? All right. Nature creates order, but not information. You know, it's like, imagine taking a room of 100,000 cards, putting a vacuum cleaner backward, and it builds a house of cards. That cannot happen. In fact, the energy required to build the house would destroy it the instant it existed, even if you could build it. That's a good illustration. And by the way, there are so many other requirements for life beyond simply DNA and proteins, but why bother mentioning those things? We get the idea. Even Charles Darwin said, it is mere rubbish to to think at this point of the origin of life. That's taken from his book, Origin of Species. In fact, I don't know if you know this, people say Darwin was an atheist. No, he was not. He was a deist. And if you read his book, he proposed different creation events. That's what he proposed in his earlier editions there. Now let's do some physics. Ready for some physics?
Yeah.
All right. Now, before the 1940s and 50s, physicists were unanimous that the universe was eternal, that the universe had existed forever. Now, generally, when scientists make claims about nature, they base it on evidence or data. But in this case, that's not why they had this idea. Because the alternative is the universe was created. And if the universe was created, that would seem logical to imply a creator. So for philosophical reasons rather than scientific reasons, scientists were unanimous in this idea. All right? But all along, in Hebrews 11:3, it had said that we know by faith that the things that are seen were made from things that were unseen. That the universe was created out of nothing, nothing physical anyway, that physical came from non-physical things. Then in the 1930s, you probably are aware of some of the outline here. Hubble discovered the universe is expanding very, very rapidly. The redshift. And then in the 1960s, they discovered the background microwave radiation, which was predicted from the Big Bang theory. Now, so here's, by the 1950s or 40s, it was a long battle, by the way. Here's what scientists concluded. There was nothing. No matter, no energy, no space, and even time did not exist. In an instant, the entire universe came to exist out of nothing in a brilliant flash of light. All right, thank you. They got caught up with the Bible at that point. Now, if you look at the actual functioning of this universe, which was created out of nothing in an instant, all right, if you look at it, that scientists have discovered an amazing set of facts about the universe. And it's sometimes called the fine-tuned universe. Let's say you had all the violins playing one note, all the cellos playing another note, and all the violas playing another note. It would be very chaotic. In order for them to all play the same note, they'd have to tune together, essentially, right? That's the illustration. So, now, would you agree that that's a small number there?
Yeah.
All right. Now, I'm going to talk about where that number is coming from. But to illustrate how small that number is, they have Super Lotto here. We had it in Wisconsin. They have it here? All right. Yes? All right. Let's say your friend won the Super Lotto. What would you say?
Yay!
Wait a minute. You're a Christian. What are you playing the lottery for? Just kidding. You can play the lottery. It's okay. I figure it's voluntary taxes, so if people want to voluntarily give money to the government, it's great, you know. But anyway, what if your friend won the big lottery again the next week?
Oh. Can I get you?
Do you ever see the movie Slumdog Millionaire? He kept getting the right answer there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What if it turns out this number represents winning the big lottery 6 consecutive times? I'm telling you, you would be in jail. Now, what does this represent? Turns out, here's what physicists discovered, cosmologists. Because the universe is created, this matter was expanding very, very rapidly. But in order to form actual things like stars and galaxies, gravity clumps that matter together. And it turned out if gravity was smaller than is by that fraction, the universe would have expanded forever and no stars or galaxies would have formed. On the other hand, remarkably, if the force of gravity was smaller than it is by the same fraction, the universe would have collapsed almost as soon as it was created. So this begs a question. First of all, why is there gravity? The atheist has literally absolutely no answer for that at all. So why does it have the value that it has? So what are the chances if you were to create a universe that would have the right value for gravity? Like winning the lottery 6 times in a row. Would you want to make that bet? And I think to be an atheist, essentially, you're making a bet of that sort. I see what I mean when I said it takes a lot of faith to sustain unbelief. And the funny thing is, like this lady in the van, she's laughing. Ha, 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 ha. Okay, whatever on that one. But the thing is, that's not the only example. There's a whole list. I think it's well past 30 now. Almost every single parameter that governs the different forces and quantities in the universe are of this sort. Admittedly, the fine-tuning of the gravity force is the most finely tuned of them all. There's the amount of protons and electrons. Where's that? That one's, oh, here we go. It turns out that's tuned to one part in something like 10 to the 30th. What's interesting is, according to the Big Bang model, protons were made one way, and electrons are made through a completely different process, and yet they have to balance to one part in 10 to the 30th. Otherwise, electrical forces would dominate gravity forces. No universe. And then there's the nuclear strong force. I know some of this stuff is like, it's okay. If you don't exactly get all of this, if you get the big picture, I think probably you're getting the picture here, right? So the nuclear strong force, that's what holds the nucleus together. It's what holds the protons to the neutrons. A little bit, a few percent weaker, and there would be no elements except hydrogen. A few percent stronger. I'm sorry, a few percent stronger. A few percent stronger, no hydrogen. A few percent weaker, only hydrogen. Etc., etc., etc. And the thing is, if you were trying to create a random universe, you'd have to get all these parameters to all be the correct value at the same time. Now, how do atheists deal with this? Well, one way they could do it is switch to a different study besides cosmology. But the other one they've come up with is, you might have heard this thing called the multiverse theory. Mm-hmm. Now, guess how much evidence there is for the multiverse theory? Absolutely none. Now, I teach a philosophy of science course, and I tell them, any claim which is neither refutable by experiment or supportable by experiment, any claim that is none of those is not even a scientific claim. The multiverse theory is literally not even a scientific theory. In fact, the only reason that idea exists is to explain away this information. I guarantee you, they wouldn't have come up with that theory if they were not trying to save atheism. That's just the way it is. All right, so let me see. Fred Hoyle said, a super intellect is monkey with physics, chemistry, biology. All right, Anthony Flew. Rather than Anthony Flew, I'll talk about my partner. I team taught a philosophy of science class with an atheist guy for about 5 or 6 semesters. He was a total atheist. And this material was in the class. And after about 6 semesters, he comes into my office, John, there's a God, there's a creator. It's like, amen. Anthony Flew, the most famous and ardent atheist in the second half of the 20th century, was converted to this idea finally, 2003? And his friend said he was losing his mind. He said, sorry, I'm doing fine here. All right, you can talk about the right kind of galaxy, the right kind of planet. All right, that's the first half of my talk. All right, the conclusion is this. Let's use Romans 1:20. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. And I would say the scientist has the least excuse for not believing. I don't even know how they do it. If you were really intelligent, you realize that Christianity is like fairies and pixie dust and all that kind of stuff. This idea is really quite foolish. It doesn't make any sense. Don't be intimidated. All right, now, like I said, in studying science, I came to the conclusion there's clearly creation and God and all that kind of stuff. But for me, it was a process of searching to find, which God, right? So maybe it's Brahman or, I don't know, Allah or whatever. And so what I want to talk about is why, even from a scientific perspective, The Bible is written by that God that created the universe. Now, again, so I'm going to talk about evidence for the inspiration of the Bible, even from science. Now, I'll tell you right now, I believe the Bible is inspired by God. I believe it for many, many reasons. So this would represent the evidence for the inspiration of the Bible, okay? And of all that evidence, the science evidence is like this much, okay? That's all I'm going to talk about right now because that's our topic. But I'm just telling you that the evidence from prophecies and all these other things is far, far greater. But I want to show you why I would claim that if you've established the reality of God, specifically which God? Based on the Bible, that God. All right, this is Dulles McCown, a well-known atheist, evolutionist and atheist. This is his statement, which it would be similar to what Dawkins would say or that lady in the van that day would have said. Christianity is scientifically unsupported, probably insupportable, philosophically suspect at best, disreputable at worst, and historically fraudulent. Now, hold on. Historically fraudulent. In other words, the Bible is full of all kinds of fables and lies and complete stories. No serious person could believe these things actually happened. All right. Now, my challenge to that one is, can you give me a single thing stated in the Bible that contradicts what we know from history or archaeology? Even one. Good luck with that one. And now, the actual evidence from history and archaeology supporting the reliability of the Bible historically, that's another lesson I'm not going to do tonight. What about philosophy? There's another lesson. I could have done a Christian worldview talk. All right, and I would say that Christian philosophy makes a lot more sense than postmodern philosophy, which is a weird, bizarre philosophy, or say modernism or any other philosophy. I would say that the Christian idea, the Christian worldview explains reality far better than pantheism or dualism or any of these other isms. But for now, let's just focus in on this one here. So the claim is Christianity is scientifically insupportable. In other words, obviously a scientist would reject the Bible. My answer to that is what I said to the lady in the van. All right. You can say that. That's nice rhetoric. But do you have a single example? I have a good friend. His name is John Clayton. Maybe some of you heard of John Clayton. He was the son of a total radical, barn-burning atheist philosopher, both his mother and his father. They were both philosophers at Columbia University and the most ardent atheists ever. That was how he was raised. And he was the head of the Indiana Atheist Society, is working for Madeline O'Hare, who was the most famous atheist in the world at that time. He was writing a book. The title was this, The Bible, a book written by ignorant people in an ignorant age. Basically trying to show in this book the reality of this stuff right here. And guess what happened to your brother, John Clayton? He became a Christian. Okay? So, now, to illustrate this, let's look at the Papyrus Ebers. The Papyrus Ebers is sort of like the physician's desk reference of Egypt. It was a compendium of medical knowledge in roughly 15th century BC. That timing is significant because that's roughly when Moses was around. All right, and let's see some of the medical wisdom found in Papyrus Ebers. Prevent hair from turning gray. Anoint it with the blood of a calf, which has been boiled in oil, or with the fat of a rattlesnake. What do you think? Okay. How about, here's another one. A mixture of six fats, namely horse, hippopotamus, crocodile, cat, snake, and ibex, to prevent hair loss. Now, clearly I've not been using this stuff. Okay. These are the kinds of things. This is the kind of medical wisdom in the ancient world. Now, here's my point. If the Bible was what these skeptics say it was, then these things would be in the Bible. The reason I know that is there's a lot of medical advice in the Bible. And the question is it like this? The simple answer is absolutely no. Let's look at some other prescriptions in Papyrus Ebers. Lizard's blood, swine's teeth, putrid meat, moisture from pig's ears, and how about human excrement as medicine? I take some of that, smear that around, and you know. Now, you guys are laughing, but really, it's not funny at all. Not really. It's tragic. Average lifespan, 20 years, if that. By the way, people could live to 80 or 90. Their potential lifespan was the same, but almost everybody died from some sort of infectious disease. Okay? Now, here's a very interesting scripture. It's in Exodus 15:26. God says to his people, if you'll follow the laws I'm giving you today, you will not have any of the diseases of the neighboring people. That his laws will prevent many of those diseases. Let's look at a few examples. For example, I'm sure everybody here is aware, in fact, even people who don't know Christianity are aware, vaguely at least in Judaism, there's certain meats you can eat, certain you can't, right? So, for example, in Judaism, pig, mm-mm. Beef, sure. All right, shellfish, clams, mussels, no. Fish with scales, yes. Now, it just so happens that every meat on the OK-to-eat list is relatively safe, perhaps even raw in most cases. And almost every meat on the don't-eat list is fairly dangerous. Pork, for example, is known to have at least 22 different diseases, many of them fatal. Trichinosis is one of them. Now, in today's modern health practices, the pork is relatively safe, but I say cook it all the way through to the middle. But beef is safe even raw. I was in a restaurant in Venezuela a few years ago, and I speak Spanish, but I don't know what the stuff on the menu. I said, bring me that one. Brought me a big plate of raw beef. And I thought about Leviticus 11, and I went for it, all right? every kind of shellfish, very dangerous. Fish with scales, right? Sushi, right? I just got back from Korea, and that's great sushi. Okay, great. And the thing is this. All the peoples around them ate all of these things and died in droves. So where did this information come from? Now, if this was the only example, you could argue that maybe Moses was a careful observer. If this was the only example, I think that argument would be, you know, at least conceivably a possible explanation. But the problem is there's so many more examples. Now, in the next slide, I'm going to show you some medical writing from an ancient Jewish source, but not in the Bible, of course. For example, the gnat, feeble creatures, or the flies, taking in food but never secreting it. Let's stop right there. According to this statement, flies don't have poop. Now, is that true?
No.
No. See, that's a science error. And there are no science errors in the Bible. So there you go. Let me see. Here's another one. Whoever touches the dead body of anyone will be unclean for 7 days, must purify himself with the water on the third and seventh day, take some hyssop, dip it in the water, sprinkle the tent, furnishings, and the people who were there. Now, this seems kind of a harsh rule. God says if you touch a dead body, you are completely unclean. You have to be separate from all the people for 7 days. So that means whoever prepares the body for the funeral can't even attend the funeral. What's up with that? Now, one thing I want to point out is every one of these laws, God didn't tell him why. Number one. Number two, if you did it, you lived. And number three, it has a medical significance to which nobody back then would have any access to whatsoever. Three facts. All right, this is Ignaz Semmelweis. He was working in a hospital in Vienna in the 1850s. This is when germ theory was first being batted about. Pasteur gets credit there. He worked at a woman's hospital. The death rate, yeah, I was teaching this in Budapest. I said he was from Serbia. They said no, he's from Budapest. and they took me to his house. So now I admit he's probably Hungarian. But either way, it was in a hospital in Vienna. Okay? Anyway, it was a woman's hospital. The death rate was 18%. Back then, women would not have their children in the hospital, not because they couldn't afford to go to the hospital, but because they couldn't afford to not go to the hospital, to have a doctor come to your home. And really, going to the hospital is like signing your death warrant. The doctors had many explanations, the alignment of the stars. They said the women are just hysterical, typical male attitude there. All right, that was funny also. All right, so anyway, here's what Semmelweis noticed. What the doctors do, they'd come in the morning, they'd examine the bodies of the women who died, and proceed immediately to the wards with the living patients and do their thing. So Semmelweis says, whoever touches a dead body is unclean. Wash yourself with soap and water. Death rate went from 18 to 4%. Now the Bible has another law, and it says when a woman gives birth, she's unclean. And even when she has her period, she's unclean. Why would God say that? Because everybody knows that God hates women, right? No, that's another joke. Come on, guys. Gotta help me out here. Now, think about it. When a woman gives birth, very susceptible to infection. Less so, but still, when she has her period. How many lives were saved? And primarily women's lives in this case, because God loves women. So Semmelweis says, from now on, even when you touch a living body that's bleeding in some sense, you wash your hands very, very thoroughly with soap and water, the death rate went down from 18 to 0.5%. Now, by the way, God didn't say why. He didn't say, well, there's germs and all that kind of stuff. A germ, what's a germ? It's a microscopic thing. What's a microscope? So he just says, don't do it. Now, it turns out the prescription was water, ashes from the red heifer sacrifice, and hyssop. Hyssop is a plant, this very, very oily plant. And if you mix the oil from the hyssop, the ash, and the water, you make a kind of soap. But it turns out hyssop has, the oil of hyssop has 10% of thymol. Now, I teach organic chemistry, seriously. See what you could get out of organic chemistry? You'd learn this kind of stuff. Okay, this is called a phenol. And when I teach organic chemistry, the first property I tell them about phenols is they're not poisonous, but they kill bacteria. Ah. You know that sort of medicine smell in a hospital? It's thymol. In other words, God's prescription when you touch a dead body is to wash yourself and everything you touch with a powerful antibacterial soap. That's interesting. Here's another one. What about skin diseases, especially leprosy? Leprosy was the most feared disease in the ancient world. Not because it killed more people. Cholera killed more people. Malaria killed more people. Dysentery killed more people. Leprosy was a horrible, horrible way to die. I'm going to leave that slide right now. Thank you very much. Fear of all other diseases taken together can't be compared to the terror of leprosy. God's prescription was really quite harsh, wasn't it? Complete quarantine. Complete quarantine. In fact, as long as there was evidence of leprosy, you were isolated from all other people except other lepers. Very harsh. And then in the 1600s, there were some monks in Scandinavia, and they were reading Leviticus. At that time, back then, leprosy was as prevalent in Europe as anywhere else. So they decided to try it. They just said, let's try it. Let's try quarantining all lepers. And within 100 years, leprosy had virtually disappeared in Europe simply by following this biblical injunction. Oh, by the way, it's caused by a bacteria. It's called Hansen's disease. It's curable by antibiotics. All right, here's another one. Two more. Leviticus 17:14, the life of every creature is in its blood. And again, like I said, Every one of these statements is true for reasons that are not explained, and yet they have a spiritual application as well. Not touching a dead body. There's a spiritual application, right? The spiritually dead. And would it be fair to say that the life is in the blood has a spiritual meaning as well? Clearly. Now, do you know what the most common medical treatment in the West was in the 18th and 19th centuries? Bloodletting. The thought was that if you have an infectious disease, the disease is in the blood. So, you know, you drain the blood to get rid of the disease. Now, the Bible said the life is in the blood. Medical science said the disease is in the blood. Well, which is true? The life is in the blood. Because the worst thing you can do when you have an infectious disease is to remove your immune system, which is, of course, carried in the blood. These are some bloodletting instruments. Wonderful thought. You know, they hardly exist anymore. Remember the old-fashioned barber pole with the red stripe? The barbers were the bloodletters. The red stripe was because they were the bloodletters. Okay, last example. So we'll have plenty of time for Q&A. Plenty of time. All right. Now, by the way, this is not in the Mosaic Law. This goes back to Abraham, to Genesis 17, the covenant of circumcision. For the generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised. Now, circumcision, that's actually dangerous. Now, it's much less dangerous than most other surgeries, but nevertheless. So, two questions. Number one, why circumcision? And number two, why on the eighth day? Again, there's a spiritual meaning to circumcision. In Colossians 2, it's given as a prefigure of baptism. All right. But anyway, why circumcision? Well, think about it. Almost everybody back then died of an infectious disease, generally either a bacteria or possibly fungus. And where do bacteria and fungus thrive? Wherever it's dark, warm, and wet. All right, well, what's the darkest, warmest, wettest place on a guy? Well, it depends on... No, Depends on whether they have their foreskin or not. Now, guys, I hope you take a shower. Okay, so the medical benefits of circumcision today they're still significant, but they're not as great as they were back then. Millions of lives saved. Mostly women's lives saved. If you think about it, it's obvious. Okay? By the way, did you know that AIDS, the transmission of AIDS from male to female is reduced by at least 60% simply by circumcision? Okay? By the way, the Bible has a better way to avoid spreading of AIDS. There's another admonition there that would also 100% avoid the spreading of AIDS, which is less painful than taking off the foreskin. All right, but why the eighth day? Why the eighth day? Well, again, the Bible doesn't say the 12th day, you know, the number 12 or maybe 3, you know, kind of a spiritual meaning. The number 8 has no particular spiritual meaning. By the way, we're going to talk about the meaning, the spiritual meaning of symbolic meaning of numbers in our Revelation class tomorrow. Where is it going to be? Is it going to be
here?
Y'all come back tomorrow. But anyway... it turns out that if you circumcise a newborn male child, there's an excellent chance they would bleed out because vitamin K does not pass through the placenta. So the baby has no vitamin K. Now, vitamin K is not what produces the clot. What produces the clot is the protein prothrombin. And vitamin K is required to produce prothrombin. Now, the infant has a low level, but non-zero level of prothrombin. So they might possibly survive a circumcision when they're born. So where's the vitamin K come from? It comes from bacteria. What bacteria? The bacteria that are in your large intestine. So baby eats for mommy, gets bacteria, within a few days starts to produce vitamin K. The prothrombin level dips at first, then it rises. It rises to an extra higher level, and then it reaches an equilibrium level. I'm going to show you a graph. Prothrombin level in an infant versus time, okay? Guess what the safest day to circumcise a male child, I'm telling you literally from the day they're born to the day they die, guess what the safest day to circumcise a male child is? By the way, the ninth day is statistically the ninth day or the seventh day would be, you know, there's no significant statistical difference there. So that's kind of interesting. Now, how did Abraham know that? By the way, the Jews weren't the only ones who circumcised. Most people did not, but some did. But why the eighth day? Well, my proposal is that Abraham did a double-blind experiment. All right? So for the first 10 years, they circumcised them all on the first day. And it's just a joke. See, that's the first joke I told that everybody laughed at. Thank you. I don't think so. Remember, my friend John Clayton was writing a book written by ignorant people in an ignorant age. And in doing his research, he became a Christian. And people say the Bible is scientifically suspect at best, insupportable, whatever. And I say, okay, that's a bunch of rhetoric. Do you have any examples? I haven't talked about evolution. I haven't talked about the age of the earth. I can leave that to the question and answer. But my conclusion is that, number one, from the nature of creation, like it says there, people are without excuse for not believing in God. Mm-hmm. Which God? Well, from science alone, I would say the God of the Bible. Now, be aware, the Bible is not a science book. It's a theology book. The way Galileo put it, Galileo said, the Bible is written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. Mm-hmm. That's a wise thing to bear in mind. So we don't read the Bible as a science textbook. It's a God textbook. But it just so happens, whenever the Bible makes definite statements that relate to things that science can discuss, it always is correct. Okay, great. So we got quite a bit of time. We could go for probably as much as 40 minutes. Questions, Bible questions, questions related to this topic, or biblical questions in general. And if we don't get to yours, if you go to my website, I've got over 2,000 questions that have been answered there. I've got cards for the website up here, a few books if you want to get some of those later. I know as college students, I'm not going to sell any books today. That's okay. Don't worry about it. But all right, great. Any questions? Yes.
So as far as like someone coming in with like questions in regards to theology, I thought of something that I remember having a conversation with someone.
Okay. Okay, one of the talks that I gave in Korea was on the existence of God. And, of course, if you show the existence of God, you've shown the existence of a spiritual realm, in essence, correct? So I think we've basically already done it, you know, pretty much. Creator, invisible creator. All right, but we could talk about the arguments for the existence of God. One of those is the teleological argument, which is the one that I just did. We could talk about the moral argument, which the premise of this is absolute moral right and wrong exists, all right, and such wrong had to have based on some sort of authority, and that authority would almost by definition have to be God. We could talk about the argument from cause, the ontological argument, the cosmological argument. Which says everything that begins to exist was caused. The universe began to exist, therefore it was caused. And I know of no logical way around that argument. But the bottom line is, if I were to pull up that PowerPoint, there's a little slide with this huge-looking equation, equals God. You cannot prove the existence of God. God is not visible. But I would say, given the nature of reality, The only reasonable conclusion is there is a supernatural. There is a higher creating entity. The universe came to exist out of nothing. All right, the only rational answer to the question, why does the universe exist, involves invoking some sort of spiritual, non-physical entity. All right? And then, you know, we could look at this list of evidences up here. Now, I wouldn't start, if I'm dealing with a hardened atheist, I would not use messianic prophecies at first. I would start with a worldview kind of argument there. But, you know, we could talk about all the prophecies of the Messiah, all of which happened, which there's something going on here. Also, here's a good thing. Here's a good question you could use. You say, do you believe that it's wrong to rape a young child? You could say that to your atheist friend. You say, yeah. And you say, on what basis? I mean, what are you basing that on? All right. And so I think the existence of non-physical reality is the most rational conclusion. But my answer is, you can't prove it. You can only ask, what's the most reasonable inference from the information we have? Okay. Next. Theological question, biblical question, scientific question. Yeah.
So, I think one of the biggest scientific heresies today, right, is this belief that the universe is 10,000 years old and that evolution is disproven because there's gaps
All right.
in our understanding. So how do we address that, I guess?
All right, so the question about the age of the Earth, okay? Now... Yeah, sure. Basically, he's asking, what's the deal with the 10,000-year-old Earth? And clearly, a lot of believers claim that that's the only reasonable biblical interpretation, that is the Christian view of things. All right, and I would go back to Galileo's wisdom. Now, I'm going to answer your question. I'm going to do a little aside, and I'm going to come back. The question in Galileo's day was, you know, the Bible clearly says the Earth is the center of the universe. All right? And if science is differently, then science has to be wrong. And the problem with that is the Bible does not say that the Earth is the center of the universe, but they'd interpreted it back then to say it because it talks about the sun going across the sky. By the way, does the sun set? No, it does not. That's a scientific error. So if you see it stated that the sun set in the Bible, does that mean that the Bible's making an error there? So the debate in his day was over geo versus heliocentrism. And he said the Bible's written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And the Bible's written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how old the earth is as well. So that caution of Galileo would apply here. So obviously we do have Genesis 1, which describes 6 days. The question is, what is the nature of those days? And what's the nature of Genesis 1? Genesis 1 is a theological treatise. In fact, I would argue that Genesis 1 and 2 is the most profound theological treatise ever written by anybody, anywhere, except maybe John chapter 1, you know, maybe that one there. I mean, it's incredible. It says, in the beginning. What do we have? Therefore, there was a beginning. By the way, was there a beginning? Yes. In the beginning, God. That means God preexisted creation, which wipes out Hinduism and Buddhism that say God and nature coexist and they're eternal. All right, in the beginning, God created. So this preexistent thing created. Created what? The heavens and the earth, the spiritual and the physical things. And so we've already wiped out atheism, dualism, etc. Okay, now... So it is a theological statement saying that God created everything. He created light, and then he created order out of disorder. Now those days could be taken literally or could be not taken literally. That you know, put it this way, Philo, the first century Jewish philosopher who knew nothing about science, said these are obviously metaphorical, these days. You see, these represent the basically first God did this, then he did this, then he did this. Origen, Augustine, the two most important early Christian theologians, also said, not because they're, you know, atheists and scientists, but because of interpreting the Bible, that these represent periods of time over which God worked. Now let's look at the biblical description. First, there was light, there was the earth, there was water, and then the land emerged from the water, then the life formed in the water, then the life formed in the land, more advanced life forms, last of all people. So, sounds right to me. You know, I don't see any problems there. Okay? So, by the way, I believe the young earth idea is not stupid or idiotic or ridiculous. I really don't think so. In fact, I teach at a secular college with a lot of sort of really way right-wing Christian conservatives. It's just that part of San Diego County. And so what I do is I defend the young earth position in front of my class. So here's how I do it, okay? So I'm teaching science, and I'll say to my class, how old is the earth according to science? And they'll say 4.5 billion years. So is that a fact? And they'll say, no. So what do you mean it's 4.5 billion years? They'll say, well, that's what the evidence implies. Thank you very much, class. You were paying attention. Good. So I say, let's just imagine for a minute, instead of speaking as a scientist, I were speaking as a theologian. And I literally kind of walk the other side of the stage. I say, all right, let's think about it from a theological perspective. Let's take as an assumption there exists an all-powerful, all-knowing, omni-this, omni-that God. Could that God create the earth with an appearance of age? Yes. I mean, on that premise, you have to say yes. You're just putting that corner there, right? So really, if we start from the existence of God, it's not inconceivable the universe could appear old. But if God made it appear old, then if we experimented, it would appear old. Now, I personally don't think that's the explanation. There's a few reasons. For example, if you look at it through a telescope at a galaxy a billion light years away, then presumably the photons hitting your telescope left that galaxy a billion years ago. So how old is that galaxy? Well, at least a billion years old. Now, could God create a universe? Then the question is, if the universe is only 10,000 years old, do those stars even exist? I mean, that begs the question. But could God create a universe where the light's already kind of on the way here? Hey, you know, John the Baptist said he could make children of Abraham out of those stones. God could do whatever he wants. Now, my opinion, that's not the deal. So young earthers should stop saying the earth appears to be young. Because it simply does not. Take a hike down into the Grand Canyon, and that theory should just take a hike, that theory itself, right? All right? But to take that as a theological position, I don't have a problem with that at all. Great, you know, how do I know? I don't know what God did. The fact that the evidence points to the earth being 4.5 billion years old does not mean the earth is 4.5 billion years old. All it says is the evidence points in that direction. But I'll tell you this, if the earth is only a few thousand years old, then dinosaurs never existed, obviously. And they're just, God created the universe with their fossils already in the ground. I don't agree with that. Okay? So I don't care. I really don't care. I'm an agnostic on the age of the earth.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yes.
Do you think the Christian God could create a universe that looks old?
Yeah, of course. I mean, Jesus made fish. It was good to go, right? It looked, I don't know, 3 years old. The wine was already fermented.
But the appearance of age that's not there is lying.
So. No, it's not. Was Jesus lying when he made fish ready to eat? He was not lying. No, he was not lying. Now, if he had said that the universe is old, but it wasn't, that would be lying. All right? Adam and Eve, when they were created, how old did they appear to be? I don't know, whatever it was. Let's say 18 years old. Was that a lie? No, so I disagree with that. I just flat disagree with that. Now, I did give you some reasons why I agree with your conclusion, but I don't agree with your reasoning there. I agree with your conclusion for several reasons. For example, the light from a billion year, light year away galaxy and the, you know, the fossils. I think, come on, let's come on. you know, the earth is old, okay? But I would not theologically dismiss the young earth idea. I don't think we can. To say, I mean, does it appear as if we're being fooled in a sense? Okay, I guess so. But God could do whatever he wants, his business. That's what I would say. All right, I'll take one from way in back. Yeah. All right, good. So who created God? Now, first of all, the very question is making a premise that is a false premise. Okay, and let me show what I mean by that. In other words, it's the classic question, right? If God created the universe, who created God? And God... whether we're talking about place or time, it's essentially the same question. Okay, because God, the God that I understand from the Bible, which, by the way, apparently exists according to the Big Bang model, is a God who exists outside of time and space. So to say, where does God exist, is, in a sense, a nonsense question. All right, and to say, you know, what was happening before the universe was created, again, is a nonsense question. Because according to the evidence, and according to what's stated in the Bible, that God preexisted the universe and even time and even space. So I apologize for cutting you off. But the fact is my answer is almost the same to either question. Okay, so God, by definition, is the uncaused cause. I know that's really fancy philosophy, but God, by definition, is the uncaused cause. Now, Jesus didn't say, before Abraham was born, I was. Jesus said, before Abraham was born, I am. So God doesn't say, I existed. God says, I exist. And God has certain properties. One is omniscience. Another one is omnipotence. Another is holiness, righteousness, justice, love. But one of his properties is existence. Now, I realize that's giving you a headache right now. I get that. So what exists outside of the universe? That question, that's a nonsense question. What existed before the universe? Again, that's a nonsense question. So God is, by definition, the pre-existent entity. So the question is not who created God, it's more like why is God? Which, that'll drive you a little crazy. See, we have to think time as a linear thing, right? A good example, there's a little book, it's like this thick. It's very easy reading, anybody can read it. It's an awesome book, it's called Flatland. You know the book Flatland? And basically, trying to explain three-dimensional reality to a two-dimensional creature. Of course, there's no two-dimensional creatures, but you just have to imagine it. And so this three-dimensional creature is trying to explain three-dimensionality to a two-dimensional world, and he can only use analogies. They simply can't grasp it. And for us, we are in a three-dimensional world, actually a four-dimensional world, and the concept of timelessness and spacelessness is kind of like, if you read the book Flatland, it's a classic, you should read it. Okay? I can tell you're not fully satisfied by my answer, I can tell. It's the best I can do, though. All right, great. Next. You had your hand up early, right? Yes. The age of the earth? So the question is, what's the relationship between carbon dating, its reliability, and the age of the earth? First of all, carbon dating has absolutely nothing to do with the question of the age of the earth. Here's why. The half-life of carbon-14 is 5,700 years. So carbon-14 is only good for measuring the age of things that are less than, let's say, about 25,000 years old. And given that the Earth appears to be more like 4.5 billion years, and the universe more like 13.5 billion years, carbon-14 is not even used. So, you know, young Earthers try to put the whole carbon-14 thing out there, which is, it's like a red herring. It's like, what does that have to do with anything? All right, now, the fact is, carbon-14 dating is reliable. However, there's a few assumptions that have to be made that can't be proved. For example, the assumption is the amount of carbon-14 in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere today is the same as what it was in the past. That by the way, that's not exactly correct. So there's correction factors. So the carbon-14 age of something can be off by as much as 5 or 10%. But we're talking about something that's 27 million years old. So what does 5% have to do with one way or another? That is a total red herring argument. By the way, the age of the Earth is determined by other methods, including uranium-lead dating. Okay? And although it is true, there are certain little minor issues with the reliability of carbon-14 dating. We're talking plus or minus 5 or 10%. And so they're way exaggerating the unreliability. They're way exaggerating it for whatever reasons they choose to. But the fact is, it's irrelevant. I mean, here's how it works. Archaeology, carbon-14 dating. Paleontology, geology, uranium-lead dating. And by the way, there are issues surrounding uranium-lead dating. For example, leaching and all these other things. All right, but the fact is, you know, because you read the book by these young Earth creationists and they say, well, you can't even trust it. How do you know it's 60 million years old? Maybe it's 90 million years old. Maybe it's 30 million years old. Well, whatever. Because they're saying 4,000 years old. That's not one of the possible answers. Again, I have nothing against the young Earth idea. I believe God could do that. But let's just not claim that the scientific evidence points in that direction. Let's also not claim that the Bible demands that. It simply doesn't. And it kind of goes back to saying the Bible demands the Earth doesn't move. And we look at that now and we go, why did they even say that? All right? Good. Let's kind of get, maybe move us slightly in a different direction. Possibly. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier about God being omniscient.
Okay.
Knowing all things.
Yeah.
How would you kind of like explain in a discussion with someone who uses that as like evidence of predestination? If God knows all things, then he knows what
I'm going to do. All right. That's a great one. Yeah. The classic one would be Romans 8, I think it's verse 31. Those he foreknew, he also predestined, right? And those he predestined, he called. Those he called, he justified. Those he justified, he glorified. All right? Now, by the way, I taught a class on predestination in San Diego a few years ago. And it was at one of the conferences. You know, we had these things called conferences, right? And I thought, they want me to teach a class on predestination at a conference? I thought that was... wow, how interesting. And I thought nobody would come. The room was filled with people in the hallway. All right, so I started out by asking, how many here believe in predestination? And the only person in the room who raised his hand was me. How could you read Romans 9 and not believe the Bible teaches predestination? You know, God predestined the whole Judas thing, the whole Pharaoh thing, the whole Jesus thing, and, you know, and from the creation of the world, you know, all that sort of stuff. But the question is, what is predestined? And biblically, what is predestined is the opportunity for salvation through the death of Jesus Christ. What is not predestined is who will choose to be saved or not to be saved. Now, unfortunately, most evangelical Christianity today teaches this tulip, the five-point Calvinism. And they believe that we have no role whatsoever in whether we're saved or not. In other words, if you're saved or not, it's all of God and none of you. That's Calvinism. And the TULIP, total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement. Do you get that? See, this theology says Jesus died only for the elect. The other people, too bad. Too bad. All right, and so it denies free will. All right, this theology says that the way Augustine put it is, we have free will only in this. We get to decide which sin we do, not whether we sin. And so that's the whole idea that we cannot have any role whatsoever in whether or not we're saved. Otherwise, it destroys God's grace. But that's not biblical. All right, so I believe God foreknows without predetermining. And I know that's another thing that's going to give you a headache probably. All right. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. Is God's will always done? No, obviously not. Otherwise, why would you pray, "Your will be done"? See, this kind of predestination, the Calvinist predestination of most of evangelical Christianity today, says that God's will is always done. But that's not true. Why is there evil in the world? The reason there's evil in the world is because God loves us. Love gives a choice. The choice had to be a real choice. All right? And so, therefore, Calvinistic predestination is not correct. So what he's saying there in Romans 8 is, those he foreknew, he also predestined, called, justified, and glorified. In other words, those who God saw will be saved, he not only predestined them, also called them, saved them, and they even made it to heaven. All right. But does that mean that therefore God sort of chose everybody? Clearly not. It does say in 1 Timothy chapter 2 that God desires all people to be saved. Obviously, that desire is not fulfilled, unfortunately, because God gave us a choice, but love gives a choice. You know, everything God created obeys him. The stars obey him. The atoms obey him. The trees obey him. Even your dog obeys him. May not obey you, but it obeys God. The only thing that God created that does not obey him is us, because he gave us free will. He gave us sovereignty. See, we're made in God's image, and one of the ways we're made in God's image is that we are sovereign. Not over everything, but we're sovereign over our choices. Why is that? Because he loves us. And again, that's why that tree was in the garden. Not the tree of life, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, because there had to be a choice. And like I said, the choice had to be real. So we rebelled. Basically, all sin comes down to this. God says, here's what you can have. And we say, I want more. God says, isn't what I have for you enough? We say, no, I want more. All right, so predestination, Calvinistic predestination, which says essentially that God chooses to go to heaven, is not biblical. All right, and by the way, that's why they believe in once saved, always saved. You come across once saved, always saved. Once saved, always saved makes absolutely no sense except under Calvinistic theology. And by the way, denying baptism as having a role in salvation is a direct result of Calvinistic theology. You know, we like, sometimes we tend to, if I can hit a sensitive subject, sometimes we tend to say, oh, those Catholics, you know. I think we should stop doing that. So I think Catholic theology is closer to biblical theology than most Protestant theology. So, you know, when it comes to Christian practice, yeah, they're way out there and all kinds of stuff. It's kind of whacked out, okay? But when it comes to theology, I would go with Thomas Aquinas over Augustine any day. And therefore, I believe that God has given us a real choice. And basically, God doesn't choose anybody to go to hell. He very, very reluctantly accepts our decision. All right? Good. Another couple of questions here. I'll come back to you if... Okay, we could move. We could talk about Bible questions. Maybe you've heard supposed contradictions. Yeah.
So my question is, why
does
God bother to create all this?
What's that?
Why did God bother to create all this in the first
place? Oh, why? Yeah, the question is, why did God create the universe? Very simple. Because he wanted to love us. And he wanted us to love him. That's it.
Why?
Because, remember I said, now, first of all, God has certain properties. Then we could ask why he has those properties. And see, God is just. You could say, why is God just? Because he's just. God is good. Why is he good? He's just good. God is love. Why is God love? Because he's love. But love requires relationship. You know, I gave a class on answering the hard questions. I think it was in Texas a couple of weeks, 3 weeks ago. And one of the hardest questions is, you know, the Trinity. Now, most of us never worry about the Trinity. I mean, it's not a hard question for us. Why? Because we never thought about it, honestly. But why is God three? Seriously, think about it. John chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, that's kind of crazy, really. You know? I mean, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. But to me, the Trinity is about love. It's about relationship. God is essentially relational. Now, you ask why? I don't know. Sometimes there's the little WY, which is, you know, why is the sky blue? Because of Rayleigh scattering. But then there's the big WY. Sometimes you just have to say, it just is. God is love. Aren't you glad it's not God is hate? Aren't you glad about that?
My question was not why God is love, but why there was a need to love another creature or being if God was already fulfilled in loving in the Trinity.
Apparently he is more fulfilled by loving us than by not loving us. He's also more fulfilled by seeing us love one another. Now you exist, therefore your parents wanted to have you. Why did your parents want to have you? Because they wanted to give away that love. I think the reason your parents had you, I don't know the circumstances, I assume anyway, mother and father married, have kids, the supposedly normal way. The reason is, I believe, virtually an exact analogy to why God wants us to exist. Because love requires something to love. And I believe it's the only explanation for why we exist. Certainly, the atheist explanation doesn't work at all. And I believe the pantheist idea, the Hinduism or Buddhism, you know, all these other isms don't give a rational explanation. But I believe love is the reason that we exist. And it's about a relationship. Now, I have to admit, really, it is kind of, if you think about it, again, I'll give you a hint. You mean, what, God was bored? Or, you know, he's like, oh, man, what am I going to, you know. We're thinking in human terms, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, we are created in God's image, so, you know, that is a kind of a good question. Just because that's the way God is. And I'm glad. Otherwise, I wouldn't exist. Like I said, all other explanations of our existence don't work. Yes?
So, you have many years, obviously, you know, more than us around this knowledge and stuff. So,
can I tell the story of how I met John Hirkman? One night, it was a blizzard in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. And this girl, Peggy, gives us a... Oh, it's the other way around. That's right, yeah. John gives us a call. You never met me. I'm part of the church in Wisconsin, but I have a friend, Peggy, who lives in Fond du Lac. Is it okay if I bring her over to meet you guys? Sure. So there's this blizzard. And she walks in the house. She's looking at like, she just realized, these guys never met each other before. And they're hugging each other. You know? And so why did you guys have me over? Anyway, this, long story short, she became a Christian. They're married now and they have teenage kids. Is this your daughter? Oh, wow. My kids were the, you know, like the bridesmaids in their wedding. Oh, a whole bunch of Hirkmans. They're all over the place. Okay.
Maybe you can expound on, with all this knowledge that's being presented here, for the typical general disciple, okay, what would you be your your best recommendation and a summary point that we can take this information and break it into the most smallest units and more layman's terms as we can to those that truly believe that there's so many contradictions of science against
right.
Really what the Bible says. Where would be the starting block that you would go off?
Yeah, I would tend to start with a worldview argument. Okay, now let me see here. my computer's still waking up. All right, I don't know if you're going to be able to see this, but the bottom line is. All people have some kind of worldview. Maybe it's an atheist worldview or a postmodern worldview or a New Age worldview or whatever it is, a pagan worldview, a polytheistic worldview. I think we can simply ask, what is true according to this worldview? And then the question is, now, are those things true? Do they make sense? And do they work? And so this would be my summary of the Christian description of reality. By the way, it just so happens that all of this comes from the first three chapters of Genesis, which is pretty awesome. Okay, first of all, the physical world is real. It's created out of nothing, and it's essentially good. All right, now, by the time you have these three, let me see, existentialism is ruled out. A polytheism is ruled out, animism is ruled out, pantheism is ruled out, postmodernism is ruled out, they're all ruled out. And the thing is, the world really is real. It actually is created. And it is good. All of creation is good. And so the only way to explain this, I believe, is with Christianity. Also, there's a spiritual reality which underlies the physical reality. Humans have both a spiritual and a physical reality. That's a basic unit of belief in Christianity. So you could say to a person, two choices. I have a body or I am a body. Now, we all know the answer, right? Right? We all know the answer is I have a body. So that means I exist separate from my body. Again, Christianity is the only way to explain this obvious fact. And even atheists give it away all the time that even they know that they have a body. For example, the atheist man says to his atheist wife, I love you. Well, right there he's proving he doesn't believe in atheism. Because in atheism, I don't exist. There's chemicals, there's neurotransmitters and neural circuitry. So instead of saying I love you, you should say I neurochemical you. I whatever. And so, I mean, everything that I know about reality agrees with this idea. And so you have to be kind of crazy almost. So you keep going through this list, the creator of both of these realities, because again, if you believe in justice, if you believe justice exists as an absolute thing other than I just hope for the best and whatever, you say yes, I say no. If you believe justice, if you believe that ain't right, if you believe that, then you have to believe this. But then what's the support of that? Certainly Christianity for one. And then the creator of both is the author of the Bible. We are both physical and spiritual, but our spiritual nature is more essential because that's what's eternal. God has certain qualities. Although the physical world is good, and I would debate with anybody who says creation itself is in any way evil whatsoever. All of creation is absolutely good. Yet evil exists. Okay, now you could say it doesn't exist, like Hinduism. It's not even real. That solves that problem. Or you could acknowledge that it's real. So where does it come from? And again, I believe Christianity provides the only rational explanation to where evil comes from. What about suffering? How do you explain suffering? say, well, it's just this random stuff. Or, but in Christianity, suffering, it has meaning, number one. And number two, it demands compassion. So in every case, the Christian worldview explains things in a way that makes sense and also provides answers that work. You know, if you go to Hindu countries, who does most of the benevolent work there? Christians. You go to Buddhist countries, who does most of the benevolent work there? Christians. You go to Muslim countries, who does most of the benevolent work there? Muslims. Because almsgiving is one of their five pillars. But the problem is, in Islam, you're not allowed to give it to anybody who's not a Muslim. All right? In fact, almost all the things we value in Western culture come from Christianity. The only reason slavery has been eliminated is because of Christian theology. The idea of human dignity and individual rights it's a historical fact that comes directly from biblical teachings. Science, if it were not for Christianity, there'd be no science. The very early scientist, the first philosopher of science, Roger Bacon, said, the universe is governed by a single unchanging law, therefore it's governed by single unchanging laws. And, you know, all the basic assumptions of science come directly from Christianity. Mm-hmm. That's a long-winded answer. Now, for a lot of people, none of this is going to do any good at all. I'm just telling you, most people, everything I said is irrelevant. They just need you to love them. Mm-hmm. And to show compassion. All right? Because Jesus says that's how they're going to know you're my disciples. Not because you have this great worldview argument, but because you love one another, because of the unity that you have. All right? So, you know, I don't want to, but I'm answering your question, okay? I would say probably just love them. Probably just treat them the way nobody else would treat them. Treat them with value, with dignity. Those kinds of things. Okay. Did I get one from you already? I think. All right. Yes.
In teaching a class like this, have you ever been stumped where you just couldn't, you didn't know the answer and you had to go back and study it out more or think about it?
I used to be, back in the day, I used to be stumped, but there's times I have to say, I don't know. But generally, it's because you can't know, generally. There's a lot of stuff that I simply don't know. Between when you die and what about heaven? And there's a lot of stuff that I don't have information on. The Bible doesn't supply information on all kinds of stuff. And so the things in which the Bible doesn't supply information on, then I'm stumped on those things all the time. For example, how old is the earth? I already said I'm agnostic on that. I don't know. I have an opinion. But the claims, for example, that the Bible is contradictory, that the Bible is inconsistent, those kinds of questions, I'm generally not stumped anymore. I've just been answering questions for so long. After a while, you know. But every once in a while, I have to go away and do some research. Yeah. For my website, that's kind of the advantage there because the questions come in and I can take as much time as I want to do research. But, for example, the questions that came through tonight, these are the questions I've thought about quite a bit. So, yeah. Okay, go ahead.
How do you go about answering all these questions and researching more things and not, like, letting your whole view, like, crumble down? Like, every time you have a...
That's a great question.
Like, oh, my gosh, am I questioning everything I ever knew?
Yeah, that's a great question. Basically, it seems kind of scary, you know, to open yourself up to all these criticisms that you almost want to isolate yourself from because they're kind of scary. And I definitely see where you're coming from on that. I see that. But here's what I do. I don't do this as an actual written document, although I suggest for some people that might want to do this. You might want to just start writing down a list of all those unresolved questions. And for a while, the list gets longer and longer and longer. It's kind of scary. Oh, no, what about that one or that one? But eventually, you start ticking off the ones you've answered. And after a while, the list stops getting longer. It starts getting shorter. Now, see, the thing is, there's a few things I am totally sure of. I'll use the example of my wife. I'm totally sure that she is faithful to me, all right? So what if I saw her having lunch with some guy? You know, I wouldn't be like, oh, man, I mean, it would be irrational to think that she's going off with some guy. I would say the Bible being inspired by God is one of those, all right? So I am convinced. You know, people say, oh, you're just biased. I am biased. When I hear, yeah, this contradiction about the Bible, I go, yeah, right, okay, well, just, all right, let's go for it. Let's see what happens, because I know what's going to happen. You know what I'm saying? I know what's going to happen. All right, so there's things I don't know about. There's things I'm sure about. One thing I'm sure about, I'm absolutely sure about, is the universe was created. Life was created. The Bible's inspired by God. Jesus was raised from the dead. That's a good one. You know, if Jesus was raised from the dead, all these other questions, like, does it really matter? You know, what about, you know, what about the fact that the Jews committed, you know, mass murder and that's a hard question. That's a killer question. But you know what? Jesus was raised from the dead, so, you know, it is a way of smoothing over these other questions. Now, let me tell you something I have no evidence for. I have absolutely no evidence for heaven. No evidence for heaven. In fact, even with God, I believe God's in control, all right? But if I read the newspaper, you know, it doesn't really look that way. Faith is belief in unseen things. And you can't take that out of Christianity. In fact, if you want to, it's very, very unwise. All right. However, there's certain things that it's not really based on faith anymore. For me, the inspiration of the Bible, that's an answered question. But, you know, if I sacrifice in this way, will God come through for me? You know, I can't prove that one. So I think the more we have this kind of solid knowledge based on clearly answered questions, I think what we need to do then is step out on faith even more. Okay? One of the ways that I'm convinced of the Christian truth is by answering all these questions and listening to these criticisms. Because I hear these criticisms and I go, that's the best you got in your gun? Could you, you know, come on. I go to Muslim websites, they're trying to say the Bible's corrupt. Then I look at their arguments, I go, seriously? That's your evidence the Bible's corrupt? You know, is that the best you got? So I think over time, all of us can get to the point where these things really don't bother us anymore. But we should never stop being open-minded. We should never stop asking questions. We should never just give quick answers. And there are questions that remain hard questions, like, suffering on some level. Even if you can give a good intellectual answer, emotionally, that's kind of a tough one. Okay? All right. It's 7 minutes of nine, and probably it's a good idea to bring to the conclusion. I could take one more question. There was somebody who I turned down. Right there, I'd already... Yeah, you had a second question. This will be the last one.
Yeah. No, it's kind of just like a fun question that I've had again, like friends and peers ask, but it's one of those ones like I don't need to know the answer, but I just want to ask it. It's kind of a two-part question. So in regards to existence and spirituality, I've had the question asked, like, so where does the soul begin? Does it begin at conception, or does God create it like beforehand?
All right. So speaking of being stumped, I'm stumped. Seriously. Because I believe we exist as a person. And when does that personhood start? Origen believed in pre-existence of souls, and that got him in big trouble, and he was considered a heretic. All right, so clearly we've not existed forever. So the most common Christian answer is we begin to exist as a person with conception. Others would say that we can exist as persons with implantation. All right? any time from implantation of the embryo in the uterus till birth, there's no other logical point to even think of. You know, and we know that we're people inside the womb. Mothers know that. All right? And so the only easily defended, sort of obvious answer is we become persons either at the moment of fertilization, if you will, or possibly when the embryo was implanted. But the Bible does not answer that question. Now, there's funny things like David says, but it's poetry. He says, from birth I was a sinner. He wasn't a sinner from birth. You know, that's just poetry. So the Bible doesn't answer that question. I believe it's from the moment of either from conception or maybe possibly from being implanted in the mother.
And then the second part of that question in regards to, you know, existing, say, that's where it starts. I forget, I haven't studied this out enough, but, in regards to, judgment, especially when it comes to, okay, for those who are to follow God, they were going to be in heaven with him existing forever.
Right.
But those who are in judgment, who will be sent to hell, it's like, I have heard people on, the side of the theory, it's like, well, the way it's explained, it's like, well, God is loving, so he's not going to have people just existing forever, especially if they're separated from him.
Right, right. It has to do with, how's judgment work with God, all right? That, to me, that's the ultimate hard question, really. I mean, in the end, how could a loving and all-powerful God send anybody to hell? But I think the way we get in trouble is we try to take God's natures and we try to say one cancels the other one out. God's love does not cancel out his justice or his holiness. And God's love says, with him forever, God's justice and holiness say, condemned forever. And those two met at the cross. All right, so there's a sense in which his justice and his love seem to work almost against each other logically. It seems that way. And I believe his love and his justice met at the cross so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith. And so at the cross, our choice comes in there. And so his love and his justice meet at the cross. For those who say thank you very much, love kind of wins, if you will, over justice. For those who say no thank you, justice seems to win over love, but justice does not cancel out love. Now, for me, in this human existence, I can't say, yeah, that's so awesome that they're going to be in hell. That's right. Amen. Good job, God. I believe in heaven that we will see it that way. In fact, I look in Revelation and I see them saying, how long, oh God, before you judge these people? I do not feel that way. I don't feel that way even a little bit, honestly. I say, God, just save everybody, please, even that guy. But I'm existing in this life. But I believe when we're in heaven, we'll say, amen. That's right. So, that's how I answer that. And it's now 4 minutes of 9, and we better end. So, see you tomorrow. What time?
9 o'clock.
9. Great.
We'll have our class on the book of Revelation. We'll have two segments, morning, and then we'll have a break for lunch, and then our afternoon. So hope to see you all tomorrow. Thank you for coming. Have a great night. Thank you.
Hello.
Hey.
I'm Bill Katona.
Hey. Just a sec here.
Oh, turn it off.